Welcome back on this fine July 4th. This is a special edition of the Rachel Maddow Show here on Air America Mornings. Today, on the nation's birthday, we're taking a little spin around the block in my new obsession, the Iran-Contra scandal, a 20-year-old scandal about presidential power and lawbreaking, where some of the most important players in this current power-mad administration, they tipped their hands, they showed their cards, and revealed their extremist, unprecedented, out-of-bounds, dare I say it, anti-American views about the president as king. The single most important story about George W. Bush's presidential power grab, the most revealing scoop of them all since W. has been president, is the signing statement story. This president's awkward little habit of keeping his fingers crossed behind his back while he's signing laws, essentially reserving the right to ignore and override Congress and U.S. laws whenever he sees fit. Charlie Savage is a legal affairs correspondent with the Boston Globe. And if you know anything about the recent controversy over President Bush's signing statements, it's probably because you've either read Charlie Savage in the Boston Globe or you've heard me talking about it on this show, telling you to go read Charlie Savage about it in the Boston Globe. Charlie hasn't just exposed the extensive use of signing statements by President Bush. He's also recently looked into where the rationale for using them comes from, tracing that rationale back to the Iran-Contra scandal. We caught up with Charlie Savage recently and asked him to explain.
In December of 2005, Dick Cheney gave a really rare press conference. He was on board his plane, I guess Air Force Two, somewhere over the Middle East. He had a few reporters on the plane with him. And he told reporters that if reporters wanted a more detailed understanding of his perspective, which means the administration's perspective, on the limits or lack thereof of presidential power, they should go read this obscure report called the Minority Views Report to the Iran-Contra Committee. And he said no one's ever read it. I mean, he was making fun of it himself, but he said this is what we think. And it turns out that when Congress in 1986 and 87 investigated Iran-Contra, it passed this very long report explaining what had happened, explaining why it was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
All the Democrats on the committee, Congress was dominated by Democrats at the time, signed on to that report. Some of the Republicans also did. But some of the Republicans, led by Cheney, refused to endorse that report, and they produced their own report. And so I went and I read it. And
how did you find it?
There's a reporter who sits next to me or in the office next door to me who's been in Washington for 25 years, and I asked him about it, and he was able to go to his bookcase and sort of blow the dust off and pulled out this thing. And he also had never read the Minority Views Report. I mean, it's the kind of thing that was just appended to the back of the real report. And it's amazing because it's the same legal arguments that the administration is putting forth now in defense of its warrantless spying program. It's like, you know, this view that was just sort of the crazy view in 1987 that some Republicans signed on to but no one even paid attention to has now become the governing policy of the country because Dick Cheney was elected vice president and his views prevail inside the administration. And the view is this: Congress can't pass laws which restrict a president's power to do whatever he wants in the spheres of foreign affairs and national security. This is their view. These laws are not binding on the president because they're invalid.
What you've proven and what you've been able to trace back is that this was a fully formed idea about the balance of power in government that Cheney brought to bear on Iran-Contra, that he's bringing to bear on the war on terror now, that he's bringing to bear on questions that have come up in the Bush administration from the very beginning, even before 9/11. And it doesn't really have anything to do with the fact that we're at war. He just wants Congress to be less powerful in relationship to the president.
Yes and no. I would say the nuances of this are we were at war from Dick Cheney's perspective in 1986. It was the Cold War, and there were Soviet missiles pointed at us. He qualifies this, or he characterizes this approach to presidential power as being one of necessity because the world is so dangerous that you need someone who's going to be responsible for national security and foreign affairs, who can move quickly, who isn't hobbled by indecision and regulations that he has to jump through that are going to slow down what is necessary for the protection of the country. A view that rests upon a need for a perpetual crisis atmosphere. At every moment of the Cold War, or now at every moment of the endless war on terrorism, we're always on the verge of being annihilated. And therefore, the president needs to be all-powerful in these certain spheres.
For out of the last 65 years, the United States has been at war for all but 14, all but some portion of 14 in the last 65 years. So if wartime is going to be the justification for something that we otherwise wouldn't need to do, then wartime justifies a whole change in government that's essentially permanent.
I've done a bit of research in connection with this. How did the founders who wrote the Constitution understand the commander-in-chief power? Where do they think it stopped? What do they want the president to be and not to be? What was the original understanding of all of this?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back and you read the Federalist Papers, which three of the founders wrote to explain every word and comma of the Constitution, they certainly did not envision this. They specifically warned against the propensity of the person who is in charge of national security creating a crisis atmosphere in order to justify gathering more power unto himself. This is the nature of man. You'll do this, and then you'll get more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And they specifically also wanted not to have a king, and specifically the thing that they didn't, because they just fought a war to get rid of a king.
Yeah.
And the thing that the British king could do, who was also the commander-in-chief of the British army, was that he could decide when we're going to go to war, or when the Brits would go to war. He could decide when to stop. He could create armies. And he had something called the royal prerogative power, which was the power to act as he saw fit in the public good, for the public good, sometimes even in defiance of, in the absence of law, or even in defiance of law, if that's what it took. And this is essentially the same idea, which is now, 200 years later, been sort of grafted onto the president, the White House, the commander-in-chief over the last, 50 years at increasing levels, maybe reaching its climax at the Nixon White House and reaching another one now.
Charlie Savage, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it
for taking the time.
Coming up next hour, we will pry me off the Iran-Contra thing here on The Rachel Maddow Show. We'll give you a few other political things to panic about and some soothing exclusive in-studio musical performances to calm you back down afterwards. Breathe in, breathe out. You're a duck. Let it roll off you. Happy July 4th. This is a special edition of The Rachel Maddow Show.